Penguin Random House Audio presents As Chimney Sweepers Come to Dust, a Flavia Deluce novel by Alan Bradley, read for you by Jane Entwistle. Fear no more the heat o' the sun, nor the furious winter's rages. Though thy worldly task hast done, home art gone, and ta'en thy wages. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust. William Shakespeare, Cymbeline, Act 4, Scene 2. Prologue. If you're anything like me, you adore rot. It is pleasant to reflect on the fact that decay and decomposition are what make the world go round. For instance, when an ancient oak falls somewhere in the forest, it begins almost at once to be consumed by invisible predators. These highly specialized hordes of bacteria lay siege to their target as methodically as an army of barbarians attacking an enemy fortress. The mission of the first wave is to break down the protein forms of the stricken timber into ammonia, which can then be easily handled by the second team, which converts the smelly ammonia to nitrites. These last and final invaders, by oxidation, convert the nitrites into the nitrates that are required to fertilize the soil and thus to grow new seedling oaks. Through the miracle of chemistry, a colossus has been reduced to its essentials by microscopic life forms. Forests are born and die, come and go, like a spinning penny flipped into the air. Heads, tails, life, death, life, death, and so on from creation to the farthest ends of time. It's bloody marvellous, if you ask me. Left to the mercies of the soil, dead human bodies undergo the same basic 1-2-3 process. Meat, ammonia, nitrates. But when a corpse is swaddled tightly in a soiled flag, stuffed up a brick chimney, and left there for a donkey's age to char and mummify in the heat and the smoke, well, that's an entirely different story. Chapter 1. Banished, the wild wind shrieked as it tore at my face. Banished, the savage waves roared as they drenched me with freezing water. Banished, they howled. Banished! There is no sadder word in the English language. The very sound of it, like echoing iron gates crashing closed behind you, like steel bolts being shot shut, makes your hair stand on end, doesn't it? Banished! I shouted the word into the tearing wind, and the wind spat it back into my face. Banished! I was standing at the heaving prow of the RMS Scythia, my jaws wide open to the gale, hoping that the salt spray would wash the bad taste out of my mouth. The taste that was my life so far. Somewhere, 1,000 miles behind us, over the eastern horizon, lay the village of Bishop's Lacey and Buckshaw, my former home, where my father, Colonel Haviland Deluce, and my sisters, Ophelia and Daphne, were most likely, at this very moment, getting on nicely with their lives as if I had never existed. They had already forgotten me, I was sure of it. Only the faithful family retainers, Dogger and Mrs. Mullet, would have shed a furtive tear at my departure. But even so, they too, in time, would have only foggy memories of Flavia. Out here on the wild Atlantic, the Scythia's bow was hauling itself up, and up, and up, out of the sea, climbing sickeningly toward the sky, then crashing down with a horrendous hollow booming, throwing out great white wings of water to port and starboard. It was like riding bareback on an enormous steel angel doing the breaststroke. Although it was still early September, the sea was madness. We had encountered the remnants of a tropical hurricane, and now, for more than 2 days, had been tossed about like a cast-off cork. Everyone, except the captain and I, or so it seemed, had dragged themselves off to their bunks, so that the only sounds to be heard, as one reeled along the pitching, rolling corridors to dinner, were the groan of stressed steel, and behind closed doors on either side, the evacuation of scores of stomachs. With nearly 900 passengers on board, it was a sobering sound. As for me, I seemed to be blessed with a natural immunity to the tossing seas, the result, I supposed, of seafaring ancestors such as Thaddeus Toulouse, who, although only a lad at the Battle of Trafalgar, was said to have brought lemonade to the dying Admiral Nelson and to have held his cold and clammy hand. Nelson's last words, actually, were not the widely reported, "Kiss me, Hardy," addressed to Captain Thomas Hardy of the Victory, but rather, "Drink, drink, fan, fan, rub, rub," whispered feverishly to the wide-eyed young Thaddeus, who, although reduced to tears at the sight of his mortally wounded hero, was doing his best to keep the great man's circulation from crystallizing. The wind ripped at my hair and tore at my thin autumn coat. I inhaled the salt air as deeply as I dared, the sea spray running in torrents down my face. A hand seized my arm roughly. "What the devil do you think you're doing?" I spun round, startled, trying to wriggle free. It was, of course, Ryerson Rainsmith. "What the devil do you think you're doing?" he repeated. He was one of those people who thought that the secret of gaining the upper hand was to ask every question twice. The best way of dealing with them is not to answer. "I've been looking everywhere for you. Dorsey is beside herself with worry."
"Does that mean there are now two of her to put up with?" I wanted to ask, but I didn't. With a name like Dorsey, it was no wonder he called her Dodo, or at least he did whenever he thought they were alone.
"We were afraid you'd fallen overboard. Now, come below at once. Go to your cabin and put on some dry clothing. You look like a drowned rat."
That did it. It was the last straw. "Ryerson Rainsmith," I thought, "your days, your very hours, are numbered."
I would go to the young and handsome ship's doctor, whom I had met at supper the night before last. On the pretext of an upset tummy, I would beg a bottle of sodium bicarbonate. A healthy dose of the stuff, I smiled at the word healthy, slipped into Rainsmith's invariable bottle of champagne, would do the trick. Taken on a full stomach, no worries about that where Ryerson Rainsmith was concerned. Sodium bicarbonate combined with effervescent alcohol could be deadly. First, the headache, which seemed to grow by the minute, followed by mental confusion and severe stomach pain. Then the muscle weakness, the thin stools like coffee grounds, the tremors, the twitching, all the classic symptoms of alkalosis. I would insist on taking him out on deck for a healthy walk. Forcing him to hyperventilate in all this fresh invigorating air would speed up the process, like sloshing petrol onto a fire. If I could manage to raise the pH of his arterial blood to 7.65, he wouldn't stand the chance of a snowman in Hades. He would die in agony.
"I'm coming," I said sullenly, and followed him at the speed of a sleepy snail, aft across the rolling, pitching foredeck. Hard to imagine, I thought, that I had actually been handed over to this rancid slab of humanity. Hard to forget, though, how it had come about. It had all begun with that awful business about my mother, Harriet. After 10 years of being missing in the mountains of Tibet, Harriet had returned to Buckshaw in circumstances so painful that my brain was still forbidding me to think about them for more than a few seconds at a time. Any longer than that,
and my internal censor snipped my thread of memory as easily as Atropos, that dreaded third sister of the Fates, is said to snip the thread of life with her scissors when our time has come to die. The upshot of it all was that I was to be packed off to Miss Bodycote's female academy, Harriet's old school in Canada, where I was to be trained to assume some ancient and hereditary role of which I was still kept mostly in ignorance.
"You shall simply have to learn your way into it," Aunt Felicity had told me. "But in time you shall come to realize that duty is the best and wisest of all teachers."
I wasn't quite sure what she meant by that. But since my aunt was rather high up in this mysterious whatever it was, she was not to be argued with. "It's something like the firm, isn't it?" I asked. "The nickname that the royal family call themselves."
"Somewhat," Aunt Felicity said. "But with this difference. Royalty is permitted to abdicate. We are not."
It had been at Aunt Felicity's insistence that I was packed up like a bundle of old rags and tossed onto a ship to Canada. There had been protests, of course, at my going alone, notably from the vicar and his wife. Then there had been some talk about having Feely and her fiancé, Dieter Schrantz, accompany me on my transatlantic journey. But that idea was scotched on the grounds not only that it would be improper, but also that Feely's position as organist at St. Tancred's was classified as an essential service. At that point, Cynthia Richardson, the vicar's wife, threw her own name into the hat. Although Cynthia and I had had our ups and downs, we had recently become great pals, an unexpected twist in my life I was still finding hard to believe. Away from her husband, Cynthia was brimming with fun. A girl again, in spite of herself. The vicar would have been horrified at the amount of tea the two of us sprayed out in hysterical laughter upon the slate floor of the vicarage kitchen. But then, alas, Cynthia's name too was taken out of the running. Like Feely, she was too important to be released. Without her, there would be no church calendar, no church bulletins, no flowers for the altar, no home visits, no girl guides, no clean cassocks and surplices, no meals for the vicar. The list went on and on. I knew she was disappointed. She told me so. "I should have liked to see Canada," she told me. "My father, as a young man, worked as a log driver, a river pig on the Ottawa River. Instead of fairy tales at bedtime, he used to tell me horrific stories of the loup-garou, the werewolf of the Canadian woods, and of how he once gave a good dunking to Ole Bull and Big Jacques Laroque in the log-rolling contest at the Rapide des Allumettes, both on the same morning. I had always hoped that I would one day be able to lace on a pair of spiked logger's boots and have a go at it myself," she added wistfully. "Now I suppose I shan't have a chance." I could have wept at the sight of her sitting there at the vicarage kitchen table, her eyes staring damply into her past. "The Altar Guild is likely just as dangerous," I said brightly, hoping to cheer her up. But I don't think she heard me. That same afternoon, Aunt Felicity announced that the problem was solved. She had heard from Miss Bodycote's female academy that the chairman of the academy's board of guardians, who had been summering in England, would be setting sail for home in September. He had been shooting for a few days with one of our neighbours, Lord Crowsborough, and it would be no trouble at all, he said, to drop by and pick me up, as if I were an empty milk bottle. I shall never forget the day that he arrived at Buckshaw, an hour and a half late, I might add, in his borrowed Bentley. He had leapt from the car and dashed round to the offside to open the door for Dorsey, the Queen of Sheba, who unfolded herself from the machine like a stork from an eggshell, a and stood blinking in the September sunshine, as if she had just been startled awake from a hypnotic trance. She was wrapped in a dress of turquoise silk, with a matching scarf on her head and far too much magenta lipstick on her mouth. Need I say more?
"Oh, Ryerson," she cooed, gazing at our ancestral home. "It's all so quaint, so tumble-de-dump, just as you said it would be."
Ryerson Rainsmith, in a summer suit the color of cold coffee and curdled cream, stood looking round in a self-satisfied manner with his thumbs tucked into his yellow waistcoat, drumming his fingers on his ample stomach. I was reminded of a partridge. Father, who had gone to the front door to greet him, stepped out onto the gravel sweep and shook hands.
"Colonel Deluce, I presume,"
Rainsmith said, as if he had just solved some great mystery.
"I'd like you to say hello to my wife, Dorsey. Come and shake hands with the squire, my dear. It's not every day you'll get such an opportunity."
He added mirthlessly. "And this must be our little Flavia."
On paper, the man was already dead.
"Mr. Rainsmith," he said, shoving a damp hand into my face.
Dogger had once warned me to be wary of any man who introduced himself as Mr. It was an honorific, he said, a mark of respect to be bestowed by others, but never, ever, under any circumstances, upon oneself. I ignored the extended hand.
"Howdy," I said.
Father stiffened. His eyes narrowed. I knew what was going on in his head. My father was from an era when gentlemen were taught that politeness was everything, that the only sure way to lose out to the Philistines was to lose your temper and admit that they had wounded you. His years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp had perfected his ability to remain, in the face of insult, as silent as a standing stone.
"Please, come in," he said, gesturing to the open door.
I wanted to give him a swift kick in the trousers, and at the same time I wanted to hug him. Pride in a parent often takes strange forms.
"What a quaint old hall," Dorsey Rainsmith said.
Her voice was as sharp as elderly cheese, and her words echoed back unpleasantly from the dark panelling of the foyer.
"We have the same trouble with cracking varnish in our salon back home in Toronto, don't we, Ryerson? Smithers, our handyman, says it's from either excessive heat or excessive cold."
"Or age," I suggested. Father pierced me with a transparent look, but I knew what he meant. In the drawing room, without being asked, the Rainsmiths subsided into the cosiest seats, while Father and I perched on the edge of the remaining chairs. After an interval timed to perfection, Dogger appeared and offered tea. I could see that the Rainsmiths were impressed.
"Thank you, Dogger," I said, "and please convey our thanks to Mrs. Mullet."
It was a game Dogger and I played, a game whose rules were so subtle that no one outside our immediate family could ever hope to grasp them.
"Not at all, Miss Flavia," Dogger said. "It is our very great pleasure to be of service." "Yes, thank you, Dogger," Ryerson Rainsmith said, out of his depth but paddling madly to keep his head above water.
"And also your Mrs. Mullet," his wife added.
Dogger gave them a 3% smile and vanished in the way he does. After a while, Daffy and Feely came into the room, pretended to be bereft at the thought of losing me, chatted in a maddeningly polite fashion with the Rainsmiths, then drifted off to their respective books and looking-glass. But there's no sense in raking through the ashes of that dismal afternoon. It was decreed that the Rainsmiths would be my chaperones on the voyage to Canada, where they would deliver me up safely to the doorstep of Miss Bodycote's female academy.
"Chaperones," Daffy said when they were gone. "Ciceronis, you mean. That's the proper word for it.
Flavia on the Grand Tour. Just think. I hope you appreciate it, you lucky chump. I'd give anything to be in your plimsolls.
I threw a handy tennis racket at her, but I missed. I missed Daffy in a very different way as I trudged up the sloping deck in the footsteps of Ryerson and Rainsmith. Daffy, at least, was my own flesh and blood and could be defied without permanent damage. Ryerson and Rainsmith, by contrast, would remember this moment for as long as he lived. He would still be telling his putrid grandchildren about it when he was no more than a shriveled pudding in a wheelchair.
"And there she was. There I found her," he would tell them in a cracked, quavering voice. "Standing on the first 6 inches of the ship's bow, with the waves breaking over her head."
He spoke not a word until we were below decks, tottering like walking toys along the heaving passageway toward the Rainsmith stateroom. He had obviously forgotten ordering me to change into dry clothing, or perhaps he had decided to deliver me up damp to his wife.
"Take my advice," he said in a conspiratorial whisper,
as if we were suddenly old pals.
"Don't rile her."
He rapped at the door with his knuckles before opening it and motioning me to go ahead of him. By the way Dorsey Rainsmith looked at me, I might have been a cobra shoved into her face.
"Look at you," she said. "Just look at you."
It is an order often given to girls of my age, with little thought given to how difficult it is to carry out, actually. I crossed my eyes very slightly, but if she noticed, it went over her head.
"Where have you been?" she demanded.
"On deck," I said.
"Why?"
"Fresh air."
"You might have fallen overboard. Did you never think of that?"
"No," I said truthfully. "I might also have been hit on the noggin and killed by a falling albatross, but I didn't say so." What was it about this woman that grated so violently on my nerves? I'm generally a very tolerant sort of person, but there was something about Dorsey Rainsmith that rubbed me in the wrong direction. I think it was the way in which she reduced her husband to less than a comma. There is a word my sister Daffy uses whenever she wishes to be particularly cutting. Obsequious. It might have been coined expressly to describe the behaviour of Ryerson Rainsmith whenever he was in the presence of his wife, fawning and cringing to the point of nausea. I looked at him standing at the door of the stateroom as if in fear of her, almost afraid to come in. He had delivered me up to her in the way a cat presents a dead bird to its owner. He was waiting for a pat on the head, or perhaps a bowl of cream. But he didn't get one.
"What are we going to do with you?"
Dorsey sighed, as if the weight of the entire British Empire were upon her shoulders. I did what I was expected to do. I shrugged.
"Dr. Rainsmith is very disappointed with you," she said, as if he weren't in the room. "And Dr. Rainsmith cannot tolerate being disappointed."
"Dr. Rainsmith?" He had introduced himself as Mr.
As chairman of the Board of Guardians at Miss Bodycote's, he must be a doctor of education, or maybe of theology.
Well, I certainly wasn't going to address him by any fancy titles. "Go to your cabin and change into dry clothing, and stay there until you are sent for."
"Go to your room?" The classic response of someone who is fresh out of ideas. "Checkmate! Hallelujah! Game, set, and match!" I had won.
Next morning, I was standing on the railings at the starboard bow, waving my hat into the wind and singing "A Life on the Ocean Wave" to cheer myself up, when from the corner of my eye I noticed Ryerson Rainsmith. The instant he spotted me, he sheered off and went astern, which pretty well set the tone for the rest of the voyage. A couple of days later, as we approached the harbour at Halifax, Dorsey told me to wipe my nose. That was my first glimpse of the new world. At Quebec City, we disembarked. A Canadian customs officer in black suit and cap asked me the purpose of my visit. "Penal colony," I told him. He raised his eyebrows, gave the Rainsmiths a sympathetic shake of his head, and stamped my passport. Only then, at that very instant, did I realize how far from home I was. Alone, in a foreign country. Unaccountably, I burst into tears.
"There, there," said Ryerson Rainsmith, looking not at me, but rather at the customs officer. The words came out as, "There, there,"
and I realized, in spite of my tears, that the farther west we travelled, the more pronounced his fake English accent was becoming.
"The little English girl is homesick," the customs officer said, kneeling down and dabbing at my eyes with an enormous white handkerchief. No great detective work there. He had already examined our passports and knew that I was not their child. What was he up to then? Was this close-up inspection part of his routine search for contraband? For just an instant, I flirted with the idea of faking a faint, then calling aloud for a restorative shot from one of the 6 bottles of Gordon's gin that, among other things, were hidden under the false bottom of the Rainsmith steamer trunk. Don't ask me how I know that. There are a few things in my life of which I am still not proud.
"Chin up," the customs officer said, lifting my face with a folded finger and looking into my eyes. He smiled at the Rainsmiths. "I have one just like her at home."
Somehow I doubted it, but I forced a weak grin. But what an inane remark! Even if he had 100 daughters at home crying into 100 silken handkerchiefs, what did I care? How could it possibly matter? One of the things I dread about becoming an adult is that sooner or later you begin letting sentimentality get in the way of simple logic. False feelings are allowed to clog the works like raw honey poured into the tiny wheels of a fine timepiece. I have observed this again and again in adults with whom I am acquainted. When all else failed, a good old cry was guaranteed to get them off the hook. It was not just instinct. No, it was more than that. It was something to do with the oleaginous chemical essences given off by a crying human, some supersensor in the nose designed to detect the altered hormone and protein levels in the emotional weeping of humans, and of the human female in particular. I had been thinking of producing a paper on this fascinating subject, tears and the test tube, but had been forced to shelve the idea when I was flung, without ceremony, out of my ancestral home. The very thought of being cut off from my late Uncle Tarquin's splendid chemical laboratory, with its gleaming glassware, its lovely old lights microscope, its rows upon rows of bottled chemicals and pretty poisons, was enough to reduce me to tears again, so that I was right back where I started. It had been in that quiet room, by the light of its tall casement windows, that with the assistance of Uncle Tar's notebooks and library, I had taught myself chemistry, and by so doing had set myself apart forever from the rest of the human race. No matter that I had been a mere child when I began. I was now 12, and remarkably proficient in juggling what Uncle Tar had once called the crumbs of the universe. "I'm sorry," I said. "I was overcome. Forgive me." The trance was broken. The moment had passed, and we were back again in the cold, cold world. The customs officer got to his feet and looked hastily round to see that no one had observed his momentary weakness.
"Next!"
he shouted as he scratched his chalk mark on our luggage. As Ryerson Rainsmith queued for tickets in the railway booking office, I helped myself to a map and timetable from a handy rack. The distance from Quebec City to Toronto, I saw, was 500 miles, more than half the distance from Land's End to John O'Groats. It was going to take about 9 hours, and we would not arrive in Toronto until late, 11 o'clock in the evening. Dorsey Rainsmith had fortified herself with a paperback novel from the newsagent's kiosk, Vengeance is Mine by Mickey Spillane. She tried to conceal it in a folded copy of the Montreal Gazette, but not before I had a chance to see the cover illustration. A man in trench coat and floppy hat, lugging in his arms what appeared to be a dead blonde, whose white silk dress was rucked up to somewhere in the neighbourhood of her tonsils. I recognised the title as a quotation from the Bible, a quotation I had several times mulled over myself as I planned various schemes to teach my sisters a lesson. Slashed across the book's cover were adverts for other volumes by the same author, such as I, the Jury, and My Gun is Quick. There was something vaguely but deeply satisfying about these titles, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
All aboard!
The conductor shouted. I was learning quickly. Back home in England, trains had guards, while buses and trams had conductors. Here in Canada, the guard was a conductor, and the carriages, called cars, were built with seats on both sides of a centre aisle, rather than having compartments, each of which opened directly onto the platform. It was like falling asleep and awakening as Alice in Through the Looking Glass. Everything was larger than life, and everyone drove on the wrong side of the road. One could easily see why they called it the New World. At last, the train jolted into motion, and we were on our way. I was made to sit facing the Rainsmiths, as if I were in the dock at the Old Bailey, facing a pair of sour old magistrates. After about 50 miles of blessed silence, Ryerson Rainsmith decided to become instructive. He unfolded a railway map and began reading aloud the names of each town through which we should next be passing.
Val Alaine, Villery, Parisville, St. Wenceslas.
I stifled a yawn, but on and on he droned, all the way from
St. Leonard de Nicolette, St. Perpetue, St. Cyril, St. Germain, St. Eugene, St. Edward, St. Rosalie, St. Hyacinth, St. Madeleine, St. Hilaire, and St. Hubert to St. Lambert.
Until I could have screamed. I tried for a while to fake sleep, but it was no use. He would lean across and shake my arm as if he were a terrier and I a rabbit.
Geography ought to be fun, Flavia, he said. Why can't you engage yourself?
Dorsey hardly removed her nose from the pocket bloodshed. She looked up only once to ask, What does a Dutch act mean, Ryerson? He went white. His face looked as if his brain were wrestling his tonsils.
Little pictures, he said, after extracting a handkerchief from his vest pocket and wiping his face.
Dorsey went back to her book as if she hadn't heard or cared. I could have told her that it meant suicide, but I didn't feel like it. Ryerson resumed reading aloud names of the places we would pass through later in the day, but this time he added the mileage and times from the printed schedule. By the time we reached Central Station in Montreal, I was a gibbering jelly. Fortunately, we had to change not just trains, but stations, and my self-appointed tutor was kept so busy for the next 4 hours, condescending to taxi drivers and bullying railway booking clerks and porters, that my ears were able to take a rest.
Then all too soon, we were off again.
"Westward ho!"
I wanted to shout. I could scarcely wait to arrive in Toronto. Not so much to reach my destination, as to be rid of this man I had come to think of as the Marquis of Mouth.
We swept along in comfort, except for Ryerson, beside the broad St. Lawrence River, which was studded with as many islands as there are stars in the sky, some with stone cottages perched in solitary and splendid isolation. I would leap off the train at the next stop, I decided. I would swim to one of the hidden islands, where I would become a modern Robinson Crusoe. Canada was a wilderness of wildernesses. They could never find me.
"Look there, Flavia," Ryerson said, pointing to a castle of what looked like grey limestone. "That's the Kingston Penitentiary."
"Where you'll wind up if you don't behave yourself," Dorsey said, glancing up from her bloody thriller. I hadn't the foggiest idea what a penitentiary was, but it sounded as if it described my present situation to perfection, and for a few precious moments I imagined myself sheltered within the high walls of that bleak and stony stronghold, safe from the rainsmiths. The hours trudged by with chains on their ankles. Outside the train's windows, Canada rushed past, as if on a rotating turntable. It seemed to me to be composed of a remarkable amount of water. And then it was dark, and all I could see in the window was a reflection of the rainsmiths. Dorsey had fallen asleep, her neck twisted awkwardly, as if from the end of a rope, her mouth hanging open in a most unpleasant but satisfying manner. I pretended she was the murderess, Edith Thompson, whose violent drop was said to have caused John Ellis, the public hangman, to commit suicide. A thread of drool appeared at the corner of Dorsey's mouth, swinging with the motion of the train like an acrobatic spider on a thread. I was trying to decide whether this spoiled or enhanced the hanged woman effect when Ryerson touched my arm. I nearly leapt out of my skin.
"Toronto soon," he whispered, so as not to disturb his sleeping wife.
He didn't want her awake any more than I did. I turned to watch the lighted windows that were now sliding by outside in the darkness. Windows in which dozens of mothers cooked in dozens of kitchens. Dozens of fathers read newspapers in dozens of cozy chairs. Dozens of children wrote or drew at dozens of tables. And here and there, like a candle in the wilderness, the lonely blue-grey glow of a little television screen. It was all so unbearably sad. Could things be any worse? Chapter 2. It was raining in Toronto. Low clouds reddened to the shade of inflamed intestines by neon advertising signs glowered above the towering hotels. The wet pavements were a soggy, crazy quilt of swimming colours and running waters. Trams sparked in the damp darkness, and the night air was sharp with the acrid smell of their ozone. Dorsey Rainsmith was not yet fully conscious, and she stood blinking on the curb beneath the umbrella her husband was holding, as if she had just awakened to find herself on an alien and most unpleasant planet.
"Taxis are busy tonight," her husband said, looking up the street and down. "There's bound to be another soon."
He wigwagged his arms frantically at a lone taxicab passing on the wrong side of the street, but it splashed on, oblivious.
"I don't see why Merton couldn't have met us," Dorsey said.
"His mother died, Dodo," Ryerson said, forgetting I was there. "Don't you remember? He sent us a telegram."
"No," she said, going into one of her grand pouts. Ryerson was gnawing fiercely at his lower lip. If a taxicab didn't come along in the next 2 minutes, he was going to need stitches.
"I shall order flowers tomorrow," he said, "for both of you."
"Galloping Galatians! Was that an insult, or had my ears deceived me?"
Dorsey turned a slow, cold, reptilian eye upon him, but just at that moment a taxicab splashed to a stop at the curb.
"Ah, here we are,"
Ryerson said brightly, rubbing his hands together, or wringing them, I'm not sure which.
The Rainsmith climbed into the back seat, and I was left to sit up front with the driver. Ryerson gave their home address.
"We'll put you up for the night, Flavia," he said. "It's too late now for Miss Bodycoat's. Well past their lights out."
"We'll do no such thing," his wife said. "We haven't a room made up, and with Merton indisposed, I can't possibly cope. Take us directly to Miss Bodycoat's female academy, driver. We'll wake them up." And that was that. In the driver's rearview mirror, I could see Dorsey Rainsmith mouthing silent but angry words at her husband. The street lights, seeping in through the taxi's watery windows, made Ryerson's face look as if it were melting. Miss Bodycoat's female academy was on a cul-de-sac just off the Danforth. It was not at all what I had expected. Tall houses loomed on both sides of the street, crowded cheek to cheek, their windows alight and welcoming. Standing in darkness among them, in its own grounds, Miss Bodycoat's was a vast shadow in their midst, taller, larger, a couple of acres of stony darkness in the rain. I was to learn later that the place had once been a convent, but I didn't know that, as Ryerson yanked angrily at the bell of what appeared to be a porter's lodge, a sort of Gothic wicket set into one side of the arched front doorway. Down a long flight of stone steps on the street, Dorsey waited in the taxi as I stood beside her husband on the step. Ryerson pounded on the heavy front door with his fist.
"Open up!"
he shouted at the blank, curtainless windows.
"This is the chairman!"
"That ought to fetch them," he muttered, almost to himself.
Somewhere inside, a dim glow appeared, as if someone had lighted a candle. He shot me a triumphant look, and I thought of applauding. After what seemed like an eternity, but which was probably in reality no more than half a minute, the door was edged open by an apparition in nightgown, thick spectacles, and curlers.
"Well?"
demanded a creaky voice, and a candle in a tin holder was raised to light and examine our faces. And then a gasp.
"Oh, I'm sorry, sir." "It's all right, Fitzgibbon. I've brought the new girl."
"Ah," said the apparition, sweeping the candle in a broad arc to indicate that we were to step inside. The place was a vast, echoing mausoleum, the walls pitted everywhere with pointed, painted nooks and alcoves, some in the shape of seashells, which looked as if they had once housed religious statuary. But the pale saints and virgins, having been evicted, had been replaced with brass castings of sour-faced, whiskered old men in beaver hats, with their hands jammed into the breasts of their frock coats. Apart from that, I had only time enough to register a quick impression of scrubbed floorboards and institutional varnish disappearing in all directions before the flame blew out and we were left standing in darkness. The place smelled like a piano warehouse, wood, varnish, and an acrid metallic tang that suggested tight strings and old lemons.
"Damnation!" someone whispered close to my ear.
We were in what I presumed was an entrance hall, when the electric lights were suddenly switched on, leaving the three of us blinking in the glare. A tall woman stood at the top of a broad staircase, her hand on the switch.
"Who is it, Fitzgibbon?"
she asked, in a voice that suggested she fed on peaches and steel.
"It's the chairman, miss. He's brought the new girl."
I could feel my temper rising. I was not going to stand there and be discussed as if I were a mop in a shop.
"Good evening, Miss Fawthorne," I said, stepping forward.
I'm Flavia Deleuze. I believe you have been expecting me. I had seen the headmistress's name on the prospectus the Academy had sent to Father. I could only hope that this woman on the stair was actually the headmistress, and not just some lackey. Slowly, she descended the stairs, the startling white of her hair standing out round her head in a snowy nimbus. She was dressed in a black suit and a white blouse. A large ruby pin glowed at her throat like a bead of fresh blood. Her hawk nose and dark complexion gave her the look of a pirate who had given up the sea for a career in education. She inspected me up and down, from top to toe. She must have been satisfied, because she said, finally, "Fetch her things." Fitzgibbon opened the door and signalled the taxi driver, and a minute later my luggage, soggy from the rain, was piled in the foyer. "Thank you, Dr. Rainsmith," she said, dismissing the chairman. "Most kind of you." It seemed short shrift for someone who had lugged me across the Atlantic and halfway across Canada, but perhaps it was the lateness of the hour. With no more than a nod, Ryerson Rainsmith was gone, and I was alone with my captors. Miss Fawthorne, I was quite sure now that it was she, because she hadn't contradicted me, walked round me in a slow circle. "Do you have any cigarettes or alcohol, either on your person or in your baggage?" I shook my head. "Well?"
"No, Miss Fawthorne," I said.
"Firearms?" she asked, watching me closely.
"No, Miss Fawthorne."
"Very well, then. Welcome to Miss Bodycote's Female Academy. In the morning, I shall sign you in properly. Take her to her room, Fitzgibbon."
With that, she switched off the electric light and became part of the darkness.
Fitzgibbon had relighted her candle, and amid flickering shadows, up the staircase we climbed. "They've put you in, Edith Cavell," she croaked at the top, fishing a set of keys from some unspeakable crevice in her nightgown, and opening the door. I recognized the name at once. The room was dedicated to the memory of the World War I heroine, Edith Cavell, the British nurse who had been shot by a German firing squad for helping prisoners escape. I thought of those famous words, which were among her last, and which I had seen inscribed upon her statue near Trafalgar Square in London. "Patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness toward anyone." I decided at that instant to adopt those words from now on as my personal motto. Nothing could have been more appropriate. At least for now. Fitzgibbon placed the candlestick on a small wooden desk. "Blow it out when you're ready for bed. No electrics, it's past lights out."
"May I light a fire?" I asked. "I'm actually quite cold."
"Fires are not permitted until the 5th of November," she said. "It's a tradition. Besides, coal and wood are money." And with no more than that, she left me. Alone. I will not describe that night, other than to say that the mattress had apparently been stuffed with crushed stones, and that I slept the sleep of the damned. I left the candle burning. It was the only heat in the room. I would like to be able to say that I dreamed of Buckshaw, and of Father, and of Feely and Daffy, but I cannot. Instead, my weary brain was filled with images of roaring seas, of blowing spray, and of Dorsey Rainsmith, who had taken upon herself the form of an albatross, which, perched at the masthead of a storm-tossed ship, screamed down at me wild cries of bird abuse. I fought my way up out of this troubled sleep to find someone sitting on my chest, pummeling me about the head and shoulders with angry fists.
"Traitor!" a voice was sobbing. "You filthy, dirty, rotten traitor!
Traitor, traitor, traitor!
It was still well before sunrise, and the faint light that leaked into the room from the street lamp was too dim to make out clearly the features of my attacker. I gathered all my strength and gave a mighty shove. With a grunt and a thud, someone fell heavily to the floor.
"What the dickens do you think you're doing?"
I demanded, snatching the candlestick from the desk. As a weapon, in a pinch, it was better than nothing. The guttering flame flared up. Breath was sucked in. It sounded surprised.
"You're not Pinkham,"
the voice said in the gloom.
"Of course I'm not Pinkham. I'm Flavia Deluce."
The voice gulped.
"Deluce? The new girl?"
"Yes."
"Oh, sheep shears, I'm afraid I've made an awful boner."
There was a rustling sound, and the overhead light was switched on. There, with what Duffy always described as strangle eyes blinking in the glare, stood the most remarkable-looking little person I had ever seen. Long lizard legs, clad in baggy black woolen stockings, protruded from the dark blue skirt of a rumpled school uniform. Her body, almost an afterthought atop those remarkably long bandy legs, was like a flattened lump of dough. A gingerbread man, carelessly made.
"Who the deuce are you?"
I demanded, taking the upper hand.
"Collingwood, P.A., P.A. for Patricia Ann. Gosh, I hope you're not too cheesed off with me. I thought you were Pinkham, honest. I'd forgotten they moved her into Laura Secord with Barton because of her nightmares. Special dispensation." "And what did Pinkham do to deserve such a beating?"
I wasn't going to let her off easily. Collingwood coloured.
"I mustn't tell you. She'd kill me."
I fixed her with the famous cold blue eye for which we Deluces are noted, although mine tend more toward violet, actually, especially when I'm riled.
"Spill it,"
I said, raising the candlestick in a menacing manner and taking a step toward her. I was, after all, now in North America, the land of George Raft and James Cagney, a land where plain talk was understood. Collingwood burst into tears.
"Oh, come on, kid," I said. "Come on, kid."
My ears couldn't believe what my mouth was saying. A couple of hours in Canada, and I was already talking like Humphrey Bogart. Could it be something in the air?
"She ratted on me," Collingwood said, wiping her eyes with her school tie.
They really did talk like that here. All those afternoons with Daffy and Feely at the cinema in Hindley had not been wasted after all, as Father had claimed. I had learned my first foreign language, and learned it well.
"Ratted," I repeated. "To the head," Collingwood added, nodding.
"Miss Fawthorne?"
"The hangman's mistress, we call her, but don't let on I told you. She's done the most unspeakable things, you know."
"Such as?" Collingwood looked over both shoulders before replying.
"People disappear,"
she whispered, pinching her fingertips together, and then, like a magician, with a quick gesture, causing them to fly open to reveal an empty hand.
Poof! Just like that, without a trace.
"You're pulling my leg," I said.
"Am I?"
she asked, her eyes huge and damp.
"Then what about Le Marchand? What about Wentworth? What about Brasenose?
Surely they can't all have vanished without a trace," I said. "Someone would have noticed."
"That's just the thing," Collingwood said. "No one did. I've been making notes. Pinkman caught me at it. She ripped the book out of my hands and took it to Miss Fawthorne."
"When was this?" I asked.
"Last night. Do you think they're going to kill me?"
"Of course not," I said. "People don't do things like that. Not in real life, at any rate." Although I knew perfectly well that people did, and, in my own experience, more often than you'd think.
Are you sure?
Collingwood asked.
Positive, I lied.
Promise you won't tell,
she whispered.
I swear, I said, for some unfathomable reason, making the sign of the cross in the air.
Collingwood's brow wrinkled.
Are you an RC?
She asked.
Why? I said. To stall for time more than anything.
As a matter of fact, she had hit the nail on the head.
Even though we appeared outwardly to be practicing Anglicans,
we Deluces had been Roman Catholics since Rome was little more than seven picturesque hills in the Italian wilderness.
The soul, Taffy says, is not necessarily where the heart is.
As a matter of fact, yes, I said.
Collingwood whistled through her teeth.
I thought so. We have next-door neighbors back home in Niagara-on-the-Lake.
The Connollys?
They're RCs, too. They make those same fiddles with their fingers that you just did. It's the sign of the cross, isn't it? That's what Mary Grace Connolly told me. It's a kind of magic. She made me promise not to tell.
But listen, what are you doing here?
Miss Bodycoats is...
I know, I interrupted. So high Anglican that only a kitchen stool is required to scramble up into heaven.
Where had I heard that?
I couldn't for the life of me remember.
Had Aunt Felicity told me?
Surely it wasn't Father.
You mustn't let on, though, Collingwood said. They'll skin you alive.
We Catholics have been martyrs since the invention of the flame, I said. We're quite accustomed to it.
It was a snotty thing to say, but I said it anyway.
Your secret's safe with me, Collingwood said, sewing her lips shut with an invisible needle and thread. Wild horses couldn't drag it out of me.
The last sentence came out sounding like...
It's not a secret,
I told her. Actually, we're quite proud of it. At that instant, there was a terrific pounding at the door, a wood-splintering banging so loud that I almost kissed a kidney goodbye.
Open up,
a voice demanded, a voice I had first heard only too recently, but one I knew too well. It was Miss Falthorn.
Turn out the lights,
Collingwood whispered.
It's no use, I whispered back. The door's unlocked anyway.
No, it's not. I locked it when I snuck in.
She crept across the room on tiptoe and threw the switch. I blew out the candle, and we were plunged into darkness. Well, almost. After a few seconds, I could see that there was still a certain amount of light falling into the room from the street outside.
What am I going to do?
She asked me.
We're not allowed in others' rooms after lights out. I'll be blacked.
I looked round the room in the strange dim glow of the electric twilight. Other than the obvious bed and clothes press, there was nowhere to hide, unless she could squeeze herself behind the wallpaper.
I'll give Collingwood this, though. She was quick. With a single bound, she was on the hearth, crouching under the mantel, and somehow clawing her way upward. The last I saw of her was those long lizard-like legs, clad in black, standing tiptoe on the fire dogs, then vanishing up the chimney. I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. Desperation is capable of wonderful things.
Open up, the voice said again. I know you're in there.
Another knock, more thunderous than the last, shook the door. If the first one hadn't awakened the entire academy, this one surely must have. Dozens of girls must be sitting bolt upright in their beds, sheets pulled up to their chin.